the barking of Conrad's yapping pooch from down the street. And there was Adams, stripped to the waist, plying the shovel, scooping out the hole, with the elm tree, roots wrapped in burlap, lying on the lawn. May 1946. 44 years ago. Just after he and Adams had come home from the war together. Footsteps padded in the dust, and Gramp, startled, opened his eyes. Before him stood a young man, a man of 30, perhaps. Maybe a bit less.
"Good morning," said Gramp.
"I hope," said the young man, "that I didn't startle you."
"You saw me standing here?" asked Gramp. "Like a danged fool with my eyes shut?"
The young man nodded.
"I was remembering," said Gramp.
"Gramp, you live around here?"
"Just down the street, the last one in this part of the city."
"Perhaps you can help me then."
"Try me," said Gramp.
The young man stammered. "Well, you see, it's like this. I'm on a sort of, well, you might call it a sentimental pilgrimage."
"I understand," said Gramp. "So am I."
"My name is Adams," said the young man. "My grandfather used to live around here somewhere. I wonder..."
"Right over there," said Gramp.
Together they stood and stared at the house.
"It was a nice place once," Gramp told him. "Your granddaddy planted that tree right after he came home from the war. I was with him all through the war, and we came home together. That was a day for you."
"It's a pity," said young Adams. "A pity." But Gramp didn't seem to hear him.
"Your granddaddy?"
he asked.
"I seem to have lost track of him."
"He's dead," said young Adams. "Quite a number of years ago."
"He was messed up with atomic power," said Gramp.
"That's right," said Adams proudly. "Got into it just as soon as it was released to industry, right after the Moscow Agreement."
"Right after they decided," said Gramp, "they couldn't fight a war."
"That's right," said Adams.
"It's pretty hard to fight a war," said Gramp, "when there's nothing you can aim at."
"You mean the cities," said Adams.
"Sure," said Gramp. "And there's a funny thing about it. Wave all the atom bombs you wanted to and you couldn't scare them out, but give them cheap land and family planes and they scattered just like so many dad-burned rabbits."
John J. Webster was striding up the broad stone steps of the city hall when the walking scarecrow, carrying a rifle under his arm, caught up with him and stopped him.
"Howdy, Mr. Webster," said the scarecrow.
Webster stared. Then recognition crinkled his face.
"It's Levi," he said. "How are things going, Levi?"
Levi Lewis grinned with snagged teeth.
"Fair to middlin'. Gardens are coming along and the young rabbits are getting to be good eating."
"You aren't getting mixed up in any of the hell-raising that's being laid to the houses?" asked Webster.
"No, sir," declared Levi. "Ain't none of us squatters mixed up in any wrongdoing. We're law-abiding, God-fearing people we are. Only reason we're there is we can't make a living no place else, and us living in them places other people up and left ain't harming no one. Police are just blaming us for the thievery and other things that's going on, knowing we can't protect ourselves. They're making us the goats."
"I'm glad to hear that," said Webster. "The chief wants to burn the houses."
"If he tries that," said Levi, "he'll run against something he ain't counting on. They run us off our farms with this tank farming of theirs, but they ain't going to run us any farther."
He spat across the steps.
"Wouldn't happen you might have some jingling money on you?" he asked. "I'm fresh out of cartridges, and with them rabbits coming up..."
Webster thrust his fingers into a vest pocket, pulled out a half dollar. Levi grinned.
That's obliging of you, Mr. Webster. I'll bring a mess of squirrels come fall.
The squatter touched his hat with two fingers and retreated down the steps, sun glinting on the rifle barrel. Webster turned up the steps again. The city council session already was in full swing when he walked into the chamber. Police Chief Jim Maxwell was standing by the table, and Mayor Paul Carter was talking.
"Don't you think you may be acting a bit hastily, Jim, in urging such a course of action with the houses?"
"No, I don't," declared the chief. "Except for a couple of dozen or so, none of those houses are occupied by their rightful owners, or rather, their original owners. Every one of them belongs to the city now through tax forfeiture, and they are nothing but an eyesore and a menace. They have no value, not even salvage value. Wood? We don't use wood anymore. Plastics are better. Stone? We use steel instead of stone. Not a single one of those houses have any material of marketable value. And in the meantime, they are becoming the haunts of petty criminals and undesirable elements. Grown up with vegetation as the residential sections are, they make a perfect hideout for all types of criminals. A man commits a crime and heads straight for the houses. Once there, he's safe, for I could send 1,000 men in there and he could elude them all. They aren't worth the expense of tearing down, and yet they are, if not a menace, at least a nuisance. We should get rid of them, and fire is the cheapest, quickest way. We'd use all precautions."
"What about the legal angle?" asked the mayor.
"I checked into that. A man has a right to destroy his own property in any way he may see fit so long as it endangers no one else's. The same law, I suppose, would apply to a municipality."
Alderman Thomas Griffin sprang to his feet.
"You'd alienate a lot of people," he declared. "You'd be burning down a lot of old homesteads. People still have some sentimental attachments."
"If they cared for them," snapped the chief, "why didn't they pay the taxes and take care of them? Why did they go running off to the country, just leaving the houses standing? Ask Webster here. He can tell you what success he had trying to interest the people in their ancestral homes."
"You're talking about that old Home Week farce," said Griffin. "It failed. Of course it failed. Webster spread it on so thick that they gagged on it. That's what a Chamber of Commerce mentality always does."
Alderman Forrest King spoke up angrily.
"There's nothing wrong with a Chamber of Commerce, Griffin. Simply because you failed in business is no reason."
Griffin ignored him.
"The day of high pressure is over, gentlemen. The day of high pressure is gone forever. Ballyhoo is something that is dead and buried. The day when you could have tall corn days or dollar days or dream up some fake celebration and deck the place up with bunting and pull in big crowds that were ready to spend money is past these many years. Only you fellows don't seem to know it. The success of such stunts as that was its appeal to mob psychology and civic loyalty. You can't have civic loyalty with a city dying on its feet. You can't appeal to mob psychology when there is no mob, when every man or nearly every man has the solitude of 40 acres.
"Gentlemen," pleaded the mayor. "Gentlemen, this is distinctly out of order."
King sputtered into life, walloped the table.
"No, let's have it out. Webster's over there. Perhaps he can tell us what he thinks."
Webster stirred uncomfortably. "I scarcely believe," he said, "I have anything to say."
"Forget it,"
snapped Griffin and sat down. But King still stood, his face crimson, his mouth trembling with anger.
"Webster!"
he shouted. Webster shook his head.
"You came here with one of your big ideas,"
shouted King.
"You were going to lay before the council. Step up, man, and speak your piece."
Webster rose slowly, grim-lipped. "Perhaps you're too thick-skulled," he told King, "to know why I resent the way you have behaved." King gasped, then exploded.
"Thick-skulled? You would say that to me. We've worked together, and I've helped you. You've never called me that before. You've—"
"I've never called you that before," said Webster, levelly. "Naturally not. I wanted to keep my job.
Well, you haven't got a job,
roared King.
From this minute on, you haven't got a job.
Shut up, said Webster. King stared at him, bewildered, as if someone had slapped him across the face. And sit down, said Webster, and his voice bit through the room like a sharp-edged knife. King's knees caved beneath him, and he sat down abruptly. The silence was brittle. I have something to say, said Webster. Something that should have been said long ago, something all of you should hear. That I should be the one who would tell it to you is the one thing that astounds me. And yet, perhaps as one who has worked in the interests of this city almost 15 years, I am the logical one to speak the truth. Alderman Griffin said the city is dying on its feet, and his statement is correct. There is but one fault I would find with it, and that is its understatement. The city, this city, any city, already is dead. The city is an anachronism. It has outlived its usefulness. Hydroponics and the helicopter spelled its downfall. In the first instance, the city was a tribal place, an area where the tribe banded together for mutual protection. In later years, a wall was thrown around it for additional protection. Then the wall finally disappeared, but the city lived on, because of the conveniences which it offered trade and commerce. It continued into modern times because people were compelled to live close to their jobs, and the jobs were in the city. But today, that is no longer true. With the family plane, 100 miles today is a shorter distance than 5 miles back in 1930. Men can fly several 100 miles to work and fly home when the day is done. There is no longer any need for them to live cooped up in a city. The automobile started the trend, and the family plane finished it. Even in the first part of the century, the trend was noticeable, a movement away from the city with its taxes and its stuffiness, a move toward the suburb and close-in acreages. Lack of adequate transportation, lack of finances held many to the city. But now, with tank farming destroying the value of land, a man can buy a huge acreage in the country for less than he could a city lot 40 years ago. With planes powered by atomics, there is no longer any transportation problem. He paused, and the silence held. The mayor wore a shocked look. King's lips moved, but no words came. Griffin was smiling. So what have we? Asked Webster. I'll tell you what we have. Street after street, block after block, of deserted houses. Houses that the people just up and walked away from. Why should they have stayed? What could the city offer them? None of the things that it offered the generations before them, for progress had wiped out the need of the city's benefits. They lost something, some monetary consideration, of course, when they left the houses. But the fact that they could buy a house twice as good for half as much, the fact that they could live as they wished to live, that they could develop what amounts to family estates after the best traditions set them by the wealthy of a generation ago, all these things outweighed the leaving of their homes. And what have we left? A few blocks of business houses, a few acres of industrial plants, a city government geared to take care of 1 million people without 1 million people. A budget that has run the taxes so high that eventually even business houses will move to escape those taxes. Tax forfeitures that have left us loaded with worthless property. That's what we have left. If you think any chamber of commerce, any ballyhoo, any harebrained scheme will give you the answers, you're crazy. There is only one answer, and that is simple. The city, as a human institution, is dead. It may struggle on a few more years, but that is all. Mr. Webster, said the mayor. But Webster paid him no attention. But for what happened today, he said, I would have stayed on and played dollhouse with you. I would have gone on pretending that the city was a going concern, would have gone on kidding myself and you. But there is, gentlemen, such a thing as human dignity. The icy silence broke down in the rustling of papers, the muffled cough of some embarrassed listener. But Webster was not through. "The city failed," he said. "And it is well it failed. Instead of sitting here in mourning above its broken body, you should rise to your feet and shout your thanks it failed. For if this city had not outlived its usefulness, as did every other city, if the cities of the world had not been deserted, they would have been destroyed. There would have been a war, gentlemen, an atomic war. Have you forgotten the 1950s and the 60s? Have you forgotten waking up at night and listening for the bomb to come, knowing that you would not hear it when it came, knowing that you would never hear again if it did come? But the cities were deserted, and industry was dispersed, and there were no targets, and there was no war. Some of you gentlemen," he said, "many of you gentlemen are alive today because the people left your city. Now, for God's sake, let it stay dead. Be happy that it's dead. It's the best thing that ever happened in all human history." John J. Webster turned on his heel and left the room. Outside on the broad stone steps, he stopped and stared up at the cloudless sky, saw the pigeons wheeling above the turrets and spires of the city hall. He shook himself mentally, like a dog coming out of a pool. He had been a fool, of course. Now he'd have to hunt for a job, and it might take time to find one. He was getting a bit old to be hunting for a job. But despite his thoughts, a little tune rose unbidden to his lips. He walked away briskly, lips pursed, whistling soundlessly. No more hypocrisy. No more lying awake nights wondering what to do, knowing that the city was dead. Knowing that what he did was a useless task, feeling like a heel for taking a salary that he knew he wasn't earning, sensing the strange, nagging frustration of a worker who knows his work is non-productive. He strode toward the parking lot, heading for his helicopter. Now, maybe, he told himself, they could move out into the country the way Betty wanted to. Maybe he could spend his evenings tramping land that belonged to him. A place with a stream. Definitely, it had to have a stream he could stock with trout. He made a mental note to go up into the attic and check his fly equipment. Martha Johnson was waiting at the barnyard gate when the old car chugged down the lane. Ole got out stiffly, face rimmed with weariness. "Sell anything?" asked Martha. Ole shook his head. "It ain't no use. They won't buy farm-raised stuff. Just laughed at me. Showed me ears of corn twice as big as the ones I had, just as sweet and with more even rows. Showed me melons that had almost no rind at all. Better tasting, too, they said." He kicked at a clod, and it exploded into dust. "There ain't no getting around it," he declared. "Tank farming sure has ruined us."
"Maybe we better fix to sell the farm," suggested Martha.
Ole said nothing.
"You could get a job on a tank farm," she said. "Harry did. Likes it real well."
Ole shook his head.
"Or maybe a gardener," said Martha. "You would make a right smart gardener. Ritzy folks that's moved out to big estates like to have gardeners to take care of flowers and things. More classy than doing it with machines."
Ole shook his head again. "Couldn't stand to mess around with flowers," he declared. "Not after raising corn for more than 20 years.
"Maybe," said Martha. "We could have one of them little planes, and running water in the house. In a bathtub instead of taking a bath in the old washtub by the kitchen fire."
"Couldn't run a plane," objected Ole.
"Sure you could," said Martha. "Simple to run, they are. Why, them Anderson kids ain't no more than knee-high to a cricket, and they fly one all over. One of them got fooling around and fell out once, but—"
"I got to think about it," said Ole desperately. "I got to think. He swung away, vaulted a fence, headed for the fields. Martha stood beside the car and watched him go. One lone tear rolled down her dusty cheek.
"Mr. Taylor is waiting for you," said the girl.
John J. Webster stammered. "But I haven't been here before. He didn't know I was coming."
"Mr. Taylor,"
insisted the girl,
"is waiting for you."
She nodded her head toward the door. It read, "Bureau of Human Adjustment."
"But I came here to get a job," protested Webster.
"I didn't come to be adjusted or anything. This is the World Committee's placement service, isn't it?"
"That is right,"
the girl declared.
"Won't you see Mr. Taylor?"
"Since you insist," said Webster. The girl clicked over a switch, spoke into the intercommunicator.
"Mr. Webster is here, sir."
"Send him in," said a voice. Hat in hand, Webster walked through the door. The man behind the desk had white hair, but a young man's face. He motioned toward a chair.
"You've been trying to find a job," he said.
"Yes," said Webster.
"But please sit down," said Taylor.
"If you're thinking about that sign on the door, forget it. We'll not try to adjust you."
"I couldn't find a job," said Webster. "I've hunted for weeks, and no one would have me, so finally I came here."
"You didn't want to come here?"
"No, frankly, I didn't. A placement service. It has, well, it has an implication I do not like."
Taylor smiled.
"The terminology may be unfortunate. You're thinking of the employment services of the old days, the places where men went when they were desperate for work. The government operated places that tried to find work for men so they wouldn't become public charges."
"I'm desperate enough," confessed Webster. "But I still have a pride that made it hard to come. But finally, there was nothing else to do. You see, I turned traitor."
"You mean," said Taylor, "that you told the truth, even when it cost you your job? The business world, not only here, but all over the world, is not ready for that truth. The businessman still clings to the city myth, to the myth of salesmanship. In time to come, he will realize he doesn't need the city, that service and honest values will bring him more substantial business than salesmanship ever did. I've wondered, Webster, just what made you do what you did?"
"I was sick of it," said Webster. "Sick of watching men blundering along with their eyes tight shut. Sick of seeing an old tradition being kept alive when it should have been laid away. Sick of King's simpering civic enthusiasm when all cause for enthusiasm had vanished."
Taylor nodded. "Webster, do you think you could adjust human beings?"
Webster merely stared.
"I mean it," said Taylor. "The World Committee has been doing it for years, quietly, unobtrusively. Even many of the people who have been adjusted don't know they have been adjusted. Changes such as have come since the creation of the World Committee out of the old United Nations has meant much human maladjustment. The advent of workable atomic power took jobs away from hundreds of thousands. They had to be trained and guided into new jobs, some with the new atomics, some into other lines of work. The advent of tank farming swept the farmers off their land. They, perhaps, have supplied us with our greatest problem, for other than the special knowledge needed to grow crops and handle animals, they had no skills. Most of them had no wish for acquiring skills. Most of them were bitterly resentful at having been forced from the livelihood which they inherited from their forebears, and being natural individualists, they offered the toughest psychological problems of any other class."
"Many of them," declared Webster, "still are at loose ends. There's 100 or more of them squatting out in the houses, living from hand to mouth, shooting a few rabbits and a few squirrels, doing some fishing, raising vegetables and picking wild fruit, engaging in a little petty thievery now and then, and doing occasional begging on the uptown streets.
You know these people? Asked Taylor.
I know some of them, said Webster. One of them brings me squirrels and rabbits on occasions. To make up for it, he bums ammunition money.
They'd resent being adjusted, wouldn't they?
Violently, said Webster.
You know a farmer by the name of Old Johnson? Still sticking to his farm, still unreconstructed?
Webster nodded.
What if you tried to adjust him?
He'd run me off the farm, said Webster.
Men like Ole and the squatters, said Taylor, are our special problems now. Most of the rest of the world is fairly well adjusted, fairly well settled into the groove of the present. Some of them are doing a lot of moaning about the past, but that's just for effect. You couldn't drive them back to their old ways of life. Years ago, with the advent of industrial atomics, in fact, the World Committee faced a hard decision. Should changes that spelled progress in the world be brought about gradually to allow the people to adjust themselves naturally, or should they be developed as quickly as possible, with the committee aiding in the necessary human adjustment? It was decided, rightly or wrongly, that progress should come first, regardless of its effect upon the people. The decision in the main has proved a wise one. We knew, of course, that in many instances, this readjustment could not be made too openly. In some cases, as in large groups of workers who had been displaced, it was possible. But in most individual cases, such as our friend Ole, it was not. These people must be helped to find themselves in this new world, but they must not know that they're being helped. To let them know would destroy confidence and dignity, and human dignity is the keystone of any civilization.
I knew, of course, about the readjustments made within industry itself, said Webster, but I had not heard of the individual cases.
We could not advertise it, Taylor said. It's practically undercover.
But why are you telling me all this now?
Because we'd like you to come in with us. Have a hand at adjusting Ole to start with. Maybe see what could be done about the squatters next.
I don't know, said Webster.
We'd been waiting for you to come in, said Taylor. We knew you'd finally have to come here. Any chance you might have had at any kind of job would have been queered by King. He passed the word along. You're blackballed by every chamber of commerce and every civic group in the world today.
Probably I have no choice, said Webster.
We don't want you to feel that way about it,
Taylor said.
Take a while to think it over, then come back. Even if you don't want the job, we'll find you another one, in spite of King.
Outside the office, Webster found a scarecrow figure waiting for him. It was Levi Lewis, snaggle-toothed grin wiped off, rifle under his arm.
Some of the boys said they seen you go in here, he explained. So I waited for you.
What's the trouble? Webster asked, for Levi's face spoke eloquently of trouble.
It's them police, said Levi. He spat disgustedly.
The police, said Webster, and his heart sank as he said the words, for he knew what the trouble was.
Yeah, said Levi. They're fixing to burn us out.
So the council finally gave in, said Webster.
I just came from police headquarters, declared Levi. I told them they better go easy. I told them there'd be guts strewed all over the place if they tried it. I got the boys posted all around the place with orders not to shoot till they're sure of hitting.
You can't do that, Levi, said Webster sharply.
I can't, retorted Levi. I done it already. They drove us off the farms, forced us to sell because we couldn't make a living, and they aren't driving us no farther. We either stay here or we die here, and the only way they'll burn us out is when there's no one left to stop them.
He shucked up his pants and spat again.
And we ain't the only ones that feel that way, he declared.
Gramp is out there with us.